Isaiah's Servant Songs, the 33rd talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on May 11, 2014, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 3, Isaiah's Servant Songs, accompanies this talk.
Okay, here's my battle plan. Today I want to talk about the 4 servant songs as a whole and make some observations about the interpretation of Isaiah in general. And then next week is going to be my last week, and I want to do 2 more chapters and then make some observations about this section in Isaiah, if there's time. And then we'll break it off there, because that's the beginning. The next chapter is the beginning of what's called Third Isaiah, Trito Isaiah, and there is a little bit of a break there, so we'll make a break there. I want to talk about who the servant is in the servant song. There's a lot of material. There is an awful lot that has been written on it. There are a lot of issues that could be talked about. What I've decided to do is to talk about the perspective of a Jewish scholar. And then there's another scholar who's suggesting that the thing that fits best is the second Moses. And I'll be looking at that as well. The question that I want to look at is if Isaiah's audience, the people that he is writing to in his generation, what kind of sense could they have made of who this servant is? Could they have identified this with anything that they knew about? Christian authors associate the servant with the Messiah, and I think rightly so. The New Testament authors associate those. But the question that I am asking a little bit different, and that is, what could Isaiah's immediate audience have made of this? And it's possible that there's nothing really that they could associate with it. I think that's a very respectable answer, very plausible answer. But I'd like to look at as to whether there is something else that would fill the bill. So I'm going to go through... I didn't know how best to do this, but I found a presentation online, and I have the URL is there for the one written by Dr. Yuri Yosef. And then there is another one by Hugenberger, and the website is also there for that one too. So you can look up both of these and you can go through them in more detail. They're both fairly long. Yuri Yosef's is about 50 pages long, and Hugenberger's is about 40 pages long. But what I did is I went through and I picked out the most significant points, and I have recorded those here, and I'm going to read through most of this. Most of it is directly from the paper, but I think by doing so, you'll get a pretty good sense of what Yuri Yosef is arguing, and I think you'll get a pretty good sense of what Hugenberger is arguing. Now, before I launch into the first one, I'll just tell you what he's doing here. Dr. Yosef he looks at the King James Version, and he is comparing that with the Jewish Bible, and he's showing where the King James Version is not quite accurate and steers the reader in the direction of understanding the servant's songs as being a reference to Jesus. And so he goes through and argues at various points why he thinks that the King James Version is an error. So that's much of what he's doing here. But as he proceeds through, he kind of summarizes from his perspective how this should be interpreted, and that is in conformity with the traditional rabbinic translation of, or understanding of this section in Isaiah. Interestingly, he only does it for the fourth servant song. He doesn't do the same treatment for the first three servant songs, which would, I think, would present some difficulties for him, but he just didn't do that. Okay, I'll go through this, and then I'll stop at the end and see if you have any questions. We can talk about just this the Jewish interpretation. In general, he makes three observations as to why he thinks that it should not be interpreted to be the Messiah. The first, the terms used in the Hebrew Bible for the promised Messiah, such as David, son of David, or king, are conspicuously absent from this section. Secondly, it does not match the traditional Jewish messianic paradigm according to which the promised future king of a united Israel, end parentheses, shows up only once and will successfully execute the messianic agenda during his reign. So it doesn't fit the traditional Jewish perspective, so it should not be interpreted that way. And thirdly, my servant is explicitly identified as Israel 8 times in, it should say Isaiah, in Isaiah. And the term servant usually refers to Israel in Isaiah, especially in this section. So just generally speaking, those are three reasons why it should not be interpreted as the Messiah, and it should be interpreted as Israel. Then he goes through verse by verse, section by section, and discusses it and explains why the Jewish understanding is better. And then he kind of summarizes how the Jewish understanding takes each of those sections. And for the most part, that's what I have retained here. So the first two verses of the fourth servant song, which come at the end of Isaiah 52, he says, Isaiah quotes what the Gentile nations will be saying about Israel in their astonishment. The dismayed Gentile nations will see a people thought to be disfigured and subhuman become exalted and successful, a people who have God with them and not against them. Isaiah reassures his people, Israel, that those who had such visions of them will be stunned when they see the Israel that they see that Israel is the one who is exalted in the end. Sorry for the typos. I tried to cut and paste, but it wouldn't go, so I had to type it myself, and I made a few mistakes here. Then, in Isaiah 53, the first section, and this is very important, from the Jewish perspective, what is said in these verses and for the rest of the servant song is the words of leaders of the Gentiles. He says, in the opening passage, Isaiah 52:13-15, it was the voice of God as recorded by Isaiah. As chapter 53 opens, an abrupt change occurs in the voice. From Isaiah 53:1 through Isaiah 53:8, the prophet conveys the words of the Gentile nations, i.e. the text reads as if it were coming from a spokesperson for or the leaders of the Gentile nations. The Gentile nations acknowledge that Israel was the victim who bore the dire penalties which the iniquities of others have incurred. The Jewish people have been forced to carry ills and pains caused by the direct actions of the Gentile nations. They have borne the consequences of the Gentile nations' sickness and have suffered and continue to suffer because of them. The Gentile nations have held that the Jewish people are cursed by God, and they were, and many still are, determined to see that they suffer the consequences of this alleged curse. Although it cannot be denied that some of Israel's suffering was due to its own transgressions of Torah, the Gentile nations, by going overboard with their misdeeds, inflicted most of the suffering on Israel, and not God punishing Israel for its sins. God has, indeed, used the Gentile nations as a rod against Israel for its misdeeds, but he is not pleased with the way that they have exceeded their license in this function. The next section, Isaiah 53:5. The Jewish rendition relates that the servant was hurt due to the sinful acts of the Gentile nations, i.e., this was caused by the conduct of the Gentile nations against the servant, and the effect was his being hurt. The King James Version rendition creates the perception that the servant vicariously took on the sins of the people, which caused him and not them to bear the consequences. In other words, the preposition for in the King James Version implies that the servant took on the iniquities of the Gentile nations and thereby caused their sins to be expiated through his suffering. This idea contradicts what the Hebrew Bible teaches, according to which the human vicarious atonement is strictly forbidden. Each person is responsible for his or her own sins. And that's very important. He is insistent on this, that the Hebrew Bible says that everyone suffers for their own sins, and therefore vicarious atonement, at least human vicarious atonement, is not a part of the Old Testament teaching. Therefore, you can't have this servant dying as a vicarious atonement for other men. The meaning of this verse, with Israel as the servant, is consistent with the history of the Jewish people and with their promised future, as was already shown in the previous segment. The Gentile nations realize that their own sickness, perhaps it is the sickness of antisemitism, became the vehicle for oppressing the Jewish people throughout the years. They brought suffering on the Jews for their own selfish purposes. It was not, as they claimed, God punishing Israel for its own sinful behavior, such as the claim by some Gentile nations regarding Israel's rejection of Jesus. Whereas the Gentile nations had believed that Israel was experiencing divine retribution for her sins, they have come to the realization that the suffering of Israel was mostly due to the actions and sinfulness of her oppressors. An often asked question is, how will Israel's wounds heal the Gentile nations? In other words, what is the process by which this healing is effected? This is a good question, the answer to which provides additional insight into the eventual redemption of Israel and its impact on the Gentile nations of the world. As was noted above, the Gentile nations have believed, and many still do, that the wounding and the suffering of the Jewish people was inflicted by God because they have been cursed. This is not true. This reproof, which has resulted in wounds and suffering, will lead the people to repent, and repentance will bring restoration. It will put Israel back on the right path, at which time Israel will merit to be healed. In the end, when Israel merits the arrival of the Messianic era, the Gentile nations will also benefit. They will be healed of antisemitism, idolatry, and other abominations. In other words, Israel's suffering will eventually lead to the world's redemption, from which the Gentile nations will also benefit. The next section then, Isaiah 53:6-7, he summarizes, the fact that the Jewish people have suffered through the sins of the Gentile nations is hardly disputable. Yet, in spite of all the troubles that befell the Jewish people throughout their history, there always existed a righteous remnant who never blamed God for their troubles. As far as their relationship with God was concerned, they voiced no resentment, and, though led to their deaths, they remained meek as sheep. Is it not interesting that the Jews were both shorn and slaughtered in the Nazi death camps? And when they were led on their death marches to the gas chambers or to the front of mass grave pits to be shot, all they had on their lips is the Shema. That's the saying that the Jews repeat that's there in Deuteronomy 6:4, God is one. The next section, now, there are two observations that I've made here where he contrasts the King James Version with the Jewish Bible. The first is where it refers to the land of the living. He says that's equal to the land of Israel. And the other is where it says in the King James Version, "For the transgression of my people he was stricken." He says it should be, "Because of the transgression of my people he was stricken." He then says, "As noted earlier, a change in attitude by the Gentile nations takes place in Isaiah 53, 4 through 7, as a new realization of Israel's grandeur was settling in their minds. In Isaiah 53, 8, my people and its iniquities inflicted the suffering on Israel. When Israel's exile finally ends, the leader of the Gentile nations will marvel at a people who survived the expulsions from the land of the living, along with all the unfair and unjust treatment throughout their time in exile." In the next section, he makes the observation that death, what the way it's translated as death in the King James Version, is a plural. And he says, "It follows that the servant cannot be an individual. Therefore, it must be a compound entity, a plurality, which is entirely consistent with Israel as this entity." And then in Isaiah 53:10, he makes the observation that the word asham means a guilt offering rather than a sin offering. And he says, in the correct context of the Hebrew phrase, and without violating what the Hebrew Bible teaches, it is impossible for someone to bring himself or herself as a guilt offering. And then he says the term seed in this verse refers exclusively to progeny, to physical descendants, and never to figurative or spiritual children. Christians generally view this phrase as being synonymous with eternal life, while the Jews see it as a long mortal lifetime. So he's amending all of those things and comes up with this conclusion then, this summary of the section. God continues his response to the Gentile nations and affirms that some of Israel's suffering was indeed punishment for the nation's own sins. However, when Israel as a nation will acknowledge its iniquity by repenting, the Jewish people will be redeemed and rewarded with growth in numbers, prolonged life, and success as God's light unto the nations. Then Isaiah 53:11, he says here, the word righteous does not modify servant as it does in the King James Version. In this sentence, it must be a substantive rather than an adjective. This verse should read, "With his knowledge, my servant will vindicate the righteous before the multitudes, and their iniquities he shall carry." Then he summarizes the section. Israel will eventually discover and understand that God has had a special purpose in allowing such wickedness by the Gentile nations, and will not challenge God's actions. In the end, Israel will vindicate mankind through the knowledge of God and Torah, a theme often encountered in the Hebrew Bible in terms of Israel being a light unto the Gentile nations and teaching them. Also, as was noted in the analysis of Isaiah 53:4, Israel was the victim who unjustly bore the penalties from the iniquities of others. The Gentile nations' own misdeeds were what inflicted the excessive suffering on Israel. The Jewish people have been forced to carry ills and pains because of the direct actions of the Gentile nations throughout history, and they have suffered and continue to suffer the results of the Gentile nations' sickness. The Gentile nations have held that the Jews are cursed by God, and they were, and still are, determined to see that the Jews suffer the consequences of this supposed curse that is upon them. Then finally, Isaiah 53:12, he summarizes, tells us that the people of Israel, as God's servants, will be compensated for having had to carry the ills inflicted on them throughout the ages, and will be rewarded for choosing this fate rather than abandon the Jewish faith and follow other gods, their forefathers had not known. As was previously noted, the idea that Israel has borne the results of the wicked acts of others is not a new concept. Neither is the fact that exiled Jews have interceded and prayed on behalf of those who ruled over them. The Jewish people will finally be vindicated. Okay, so that's his presentation. Now, I have a few comments here. I should have numbered them. The first one I should have listed as number one, the one that starts with Dr. Yosef, and then I've got three more. My first comment is, well, I should point out, all in all, what he presents is well argued, and there are many places where he, I think, makes a good case that the King James Version was probably not the best translation. He didn't take on the New American Standard or any of the more modern translations. Had he done so, there would have been fewer complaints that he could have raised with respect to the translation. And those translations are compatible with this being a reference to the Messiah. But he does raise some very good points. But I have these four things that are of concern to me with respect to his analysis. The first is he doesn't address the other servant songs at all. And I think that he would have some difficulty in making all of the servant songs fit in with his interpretation. The second one, which I numbered one here, is the switch to the thoughts of the Gentile nations in chapter 53 is strange. It is strange in his interpretation that all of a sudden, at verse 1 of chapter 53, he says, this is from the perspective of the Gentile nations. Now, I have to admit, there's much in Isaiah that's strange. So to say that it's strange doesn't necessarily rule it out, but it is odd and, to my knowledge, unprecedented to have a spokesman for the Gentile nations in this kind of literature. The second is, according to his interpretation then, it's the Gentiles who are saying, we are like sheep who have gone astray. And I don't know where else you would see that kind of language where Gentiles are referred to as being like sheep who have been led astray from God. There may be such a reference, but I'm not aware of it. And then my last one is most of Dr. Yosef's resistance to seeing the servant as a Christ-like figure is his insistence that vicarious atonement is contrary to Old Testament teaching. I think it's interesting that he says it's vicarious human atonement. He's obviously aware of the sacrificial system in which sins are atoned for by sacrifices, animal sacrifices. So the concept is certainly there. He is just saying that there isn't this kind of human vicarious atonement. And it just seems to me that that is a concept, at least the concept of God being merciful, being one who pardons, is widespread in the Old Testament. Just this last week, with some others, I was looking at Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 1. It says, roam to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and look now, and take note, and seek in their open squares if you can find a man, if there is one who does justice, who seeks truth, then I will pardon her. So if one can be found who is just, God is willing to pardon Jerusalem. So the concept of, certainly the concept of a pardon for mankind on the basis of one just one is certainly an Old Testament concept. Okay. Are there any questions on this, on the Jewish interpretation that you'd like me to address?
The Jewish Bible. Who translated it and what text did they use to translate it and so on?
The one that he is using?
Yes.
It's an English translation, and he doesn't say. I'm assuming it's the one by, what is it, the Jewish JPS. Mm-hmm. I assume it's that one.
Okay. And I'm kind of questioning why he didn't refer to Greek in this, because I think that would have...
He refers to the Septuagint on two occasions.
Okay.
And claims that that is a Christian translation.
Interesting. That's not.
Huh.
Yeah, and he sounded a little bit pharisaical.
What?
I said, he sounds a little pharisaical with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not... I don't know how widespread that perspective would be.
Right.
I was a little surprised when I saw it, but that's what he says. So yeah. He doesn't refer to the Septuagint whatsoever.
Now, is this typical of certain things that he writes about that maybe in the background we aren't following traditions like we should? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Well, he clearly very respectful of Jewish tradition, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so this is a typical of him to look at Jewish traditions and...
This is the only thing that I've read by him, but that's certainly he is certainly respectful of Jewish tradition in here.
Okay.
And so that, it's interesting because that's part of his interpretive method, is he's assuming some things from rabbinic teachings.
Because I was just interested because when you look at writings or almost anything... You need to look at the background, like, you know, why is this being done? Who's funding? You know, where did he get his doctorate? So on and so on. Okay, thank you.
There's a tension in these notes that is confusing to me. Maybe having read the thing, you can clear it up. On the one hand, he says the Gentiles are not being used by God to simply chastise Israel. The Gentiles have gone overboard, above and beyond, and that's their sin, on the one hand.
Right.
On the other hand, he says it's redemptive,
right?
That it's going to lead Israel to repentance, and I would think that that would imply that God is behind it. How does he reconcile that? Or?
He doesn't really reconcile that. The sense that I get is that I don't think that he would buy divine sovereignty entirely.
Okay.
Because there's just too much in there that would suggest otherwise.
Okay.
So it's, yeah. God's in charge of history, and he directs history where it's going, but not in every detail. I think that seems to be his perspective.
Hi, David. Thank you. So I was looking for how long ago this was written.
Was written in 2011, I think.
It just seems very strange to me that he would focus on the King James Version.
Yes.
If it was written so recently.
Yes.
The King James was a fine translation at the time.
Yes.
But we've discovered a lot.
And yeah. Exactly.
I mean, does he have a lot of credibility with Jewish people in general?
I don't know much about him. I just looked at his website, and he works for an organization that helps Jews respond to what are called Christian missionaries. A Christian missionary is anybody who tries to convert Jews to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so this was written to equip Jews to deal with that. It is interesting that he takes on the King James Version because it's a softer target than some of the more modern translations would be. It's a, like you say, it's an outstanding translation given when it was translated, but we have learned a lot about biblical Hebrew. Even in the last 20 years, we've learned quite a bit about biblical Hebrew.
It just seems like a huge straw man to me.
It is. I suspect that he would defend it by saying, but it has been the standard Protestant Bible. And so that's why I'm taking it on. But yes, it gives him a lot more targets that he can aim at as he proceeds through.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
When he asserts that vicarious atonement is contrary to Old Testament teachings, do you think he's looking at atonement in an orthodox way, that the Messiah paid the price?
Yeah, he's saying that can't be.
Okay. So if we look at it and agree with him that, of course, individuals are responsible for his or her own sins.
Yes.
Then it's a different view of atonement. Rather than the orthodox view of Jesus paying a price,
uh-huh.
rather than looking at the atonement as Jack is teaching, if I understand it right, that it's a depiction of what we each as individuals deserve.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what's the contrast you're making?
Well, I'm thinking that he's disagreeing with the Orthodox view of the atonement.
Yes.
Okay. And the same argument could not apply to the view that I have.
Yes, right. That's right.
And piggybacking on that, wouldn't that have to be based on, in some way, his view of the sacrificial atonements in the Old Testament, that they actually, quote-unquote, worked?
He doesn't talk about that at all, but I would assume that he's thinking that they did work.
Okay.
And that's why he has human vicarious atonement, because animal vicarious atonement works. I assume that's what he's doing.
That's what I cued on. And in some of the earlier stuff, is he actually saying that the Gentiles nations acknowledged that the Jews' God was actually God? Doesn't it sort of hinge on the voice saying, yes, Yahweh used us to do this to you?
I think so.
And we think that doesn't sound like the picture we get that Isaiah has of the Gentile nations, that he would say they don't believe that God is God, but this teacher is saying that the Gentiles in this passage do believe that God is God.
Well, there will be Gentiles. I think Isaiah is teaching that Gentiles, there will be Gentiles who will reach the point where they recognize that God is God.
But that the ones during the time of Isaiah's writing already did is sort of the
feeling. No, I think he's seeing this as a future thing. There will come a time in the future when the Gentiles will have this kind of response. They will come to the place where they recognize we have done horrible things to God's people.
Okay.
And we shouldn't have done that. And it's because of the Jews suffering that patiently and over a long period of time that the Gentile nations will finally wake up and recognize what they've done and be sorry for that, be repentant.
Good luck with that.
He does virtually nothing with that. And it's interesting, he makes a big deal about the deaths just above that, and grave is in parallel with that, and that is singular. But that's the whole... As I recall, that's the only thing he talks about is deaths at that point.
Do you think he could clarify what Biach means on in the section on Isaiah 51:4 about the Jewish people forced to carry ills and pains caused by the direct action of the Gentile nations?
Where are you?
First page, second paragraph of Isaiah 53:1-4.
Uh-huh. And it's that last paragraph?
Yes.
And which part?
Second sentence.
The Jewish people have been forced to carry ills and pains caused by the direct action of the Gentile nations. That is, they have suffered at the hands of Gentiles. That's what he takes that language to mean. So Jews have suffered at the hands of Gentiles. As he goes on later to explain, a lot of that is the result of antisemitism. Am I answering your question, or is I?
Somewhat. I'm still trying to figure how that connection is, or maybe I'm just reading it that God is punishing the Jews for the sins of the Gentiles.
No, he doesn't see it that way. That the Jewish people, they suffer because suffering is inflicted on them by the Gentiles. So the Holocaust, for instance, would be the Jews suffering because pain and suffering was inflicted on them by the Gentiles. But what happens is, and God allows that to a certain extent, but the Gentiles go too far. And as a result, God then cuts that off and punishes the Gentiles.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
Sorry to ask one more question, but many times when I'm reading in the Bible, the Gentiles go in Israel and so on, I sometimes think, interpreted, that God uses Gentiles to punish the Jews. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't seem to be saying that on that.
I think he would agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Because
mm-hmm. I'm sure the model that he has in mind is one that Isaiah talked about earlier, where he talks about the Assyrians, bringing in the Assyrians to punish Israel, the northern kingdom. And they came in and they punished the northern kingdom, but they were arrogant in doing so. And so God turns around and punishes the Assyrians.
Okay, so
that's all stuff that I think Isaiah clearly teaches. Mm-hmm. So he's seeing that as extending to this passage as well.
Okay, so dynamic. The interpretation would be that he says the Gentiles are used as God's instruments, but they just go too far.
They go too far. Yeah, for him, it's they go too far. That Isaiah early, it was the spirit in which they carried it out that was wrong. It was rebellious. That was wrong. Here, it's that they go too far. They go far beyond what was required.
Okay. So I interpret that as God letting things go on until basically Israel starts to repent. That would be my interpretation on a lot of the things where Israel has gone through judgment. Mm-hmm. That it seems very clear that when Israel gets down and repents, that's when the Gentiles. So I don't quite agree with what he has to say about the Gentiles going too far. To me, it's more of, what do you expect? You know, because, I mean, that's so typical of so many evil things, to just go too far. I mean, that's just very typical of human nature, not just the Gentiles and so on. I mean, would that be somewhat of a correct interpretation?
Well, from my perspective, I would be reluctant to say go too far.
Okay.
Because I see God in control of that, even no matter how far it goes, God's in control of that. And it goes until he's accomplished his purposes, whatever those purposes are. But as we saw earlier in Isaiah, God does hold the Gentiles responsible for the punishment that he has them inflict on his people for the way in which they do it.
Oh, yes. I don't question God's judgment for the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's like using God, like to me, like going back to the Exodus. Mm-hmm. It was God said, I harden, you know, Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
You know, God is doing the action, but we still have to pay the consequences, so to speak. So, I mean, I agree with that, but I'm a little, if you could say, disagree with you on the Gentiles really going too far. Yes, they are, but to me, it's just, that's just human nature, that it would be something, how can I say, it seems like he's saying that God tells them to do this and then they do extra. And I don't really see it that way.
Right, and I would agree with that.
Yeah, okay.
David, how does he interpret the pronoun he all through chapter 53? Mm-hmm. Does he see that as a plural instead of a singular?
He does.
And then when it says in 3, a man of sorrows, so that isn't singular, that would be men? Or is he translating all this as Gentile nations?
Okay, some of them, he sees Israel as a singular. The servant is Israel, and that's a singular. So usually you will find singulars there. But there are some pronouns here that are singular in form, and he makes a good argument for this. They are singular in form, but they are plural in sense. And so the King James Version translates them as singular, and I think the New American Standard, there are a couple places where it's singular, but it's actually plural in sense, is what he argues.
Is that common?
Well, he argues that is the poetic form. That the singular form is the poetic form for the plural. And I'd have to look back exactly where that occurs, but there are two or three places where that occurs. Mm-hmm. And I think he's making a good argument for it, but the New American Standard has made an adjustment for that and has incorporated that in, whereas the King James did not.
Yeah, some of that's kind of convenient.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm back to that same question again. In that paragraph of 1 through 4, on the 5th sentence or 5th line.
Where, I'm sorry, which page are you on?
53, 1-4.
Okay.
And if you go down 5 lines where he has Gentile parentheses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He says, the Gentile nations have held that the Jewish people are cursed by God, and they were determined to see that they suffer the consequences of this alleged curse. That's what led me to think that he thinks that the Gentiles are willing participants with God in carrying out the curse against the Jews,
okay.
Which means they would have to acknowledge God as God. To do that, at least the way he's written it. That's what
okay.
Made me wonder.
I don't think you would necessarily see it that way. They are cooperating with God, but whether they know they're cooperating with God or not is another question. That what he's identifying here is the Gentile nations look at the Jews and they see them as cursed by God, but they're cursed by the Christian God, not necessarily Yahweh. And therefore... He's essentially talking about the Middle Ages.
So he's not even referring to what Isaiah is talking about during the time of Isaiah here, when he talks about them seeing to it that the Jews suffer the consequences of this alleged curse. He's not even addressed what the Syrians are about to do or them being hauled off into captivity. Or he doesn't count that among the...
That may be... I don't know if he's including that or not. I don't know if he's including that or not. But I think what he has in mind is the Christian centuries and what the Jews suffered at the hands of Christians.
Okay.
At least primarily. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Let's look at the other identification of the servant. This is by Hugenberger. I don't know who he is, but he wrote this paper, and I think he wrote this in 2009. It wasn't too long ago. And he argues that the servant should be identified with a second Moses figure. And I will just read through what the highlights of what he wrote. He says, and he start his first the first paragraph I have from him is one that I think is very good and very possible. He says, indeed, the prophet may have drawn from such a rich diversity of sources for the composite picture he paints that any attempt to identify the servant figure is necessarily reductionistic. And I think that's a very good possibility. But he goes on and tries to make such an identification. He says, Rabbi Simlai advanced the hypothesis in the Talmud in the 3rd century that the servant is a second Moses, and that's the one that he's going to develop. It is widely recognized that the controlling and sustained theme of these chapters, by these chapters he means the section that we've been looking at, the second Isaiah section, is that of a second Exodus. Isaiah grounds his promise of a second Exodus in the reality of the first Exodus. Moreover, since Yahweh personally led Israel out of Egypt and provided light for their way, once again Yahweh will personally lead his people and turn their darkness into light. As the original Exodus was intended to draw God's people into a covenant with himself, so also this second Exodus will result in an everlasting covenant, according to 61:8. Since the original Exodus resulted in Israel's calling to be a kingdom of priests, and the subsequent establishment of the Levitical priesthood, so this new Exodus will issue in a renewed calling to be priests of Yahweh, 61:6, so we haven't got to that yet, and a surprising new selection of priests and Levites, quote, and I will also take some of them, that is of Tarshish, Libya, Lydia, Tubal, and Greece, as priests and as Levites, says Yahweh. Furthermore, as Isaiah 48:20 and following makes clear, because Yahweh miraculously provided water for his people in the original Exodus, a similar provision is assured for the second Exodus. And then he quotes from Isaiah, go out from Babylon, flee from Chaldea, declare this with a shout of joy, proclaim it, send it forth to the end of the earth, say Yahweh has redeemed his servant Jacob. They did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made water flow for them from the rock. He split open the rock, and the water gushed out. He goes on to say, as noted by Gerhard von Rad, the prominence of the second Exodus theme in Deutero-Isaiah invites, if it does not demand, an identification of the servant of the Lord with a second Moses figure. Isaiah 63:11 through 19 offers important evidence for this association. In their desperation, the people cry out for a new Exodus, and with it, at least implicitly, a new Moses. Then they remembered the days of old of Moses, his servant. Where is the one who brought them up out of the sea? Where is the one who put within them his Holy Spirit, who caused his glorious arm to march at the right hand of Moses, who divided the waters before them? So he's saying, in this whole section of Isaiah, there's a strong association between the Exodus and the events that are coming up that he's prophesying, and therefore a need for a Moses, another Moses. So he goes through and gives about 14 reasons why he thinks the servant in the servant songs is a second Moses. First, except for David, no individual is more frequently identified as servant of the Lord than Moses. That's 18 times, and all four times that the term servant of God is used. Second, all the evidence cited earlier for the royal, priestly, and especially prophetic characters of the servant figure is easily accommodated if the figure is understood as a reference to the promised prophet like Moses mentioned in Deuteronomy. The third, an identification of the servant with a second Moses figure provides a ready solution for the problem of the corporate versus individual identity of the servant figure. At Israel's own request, Moses was the representative of his people. Furthermore, not only was Moses' life exemplary in terms of faith and obedience, but also it provided a pattern for Israel's experience. His calling was in large measure theirs. In other words, the relationship between Moses and Israel is analogous to the relationship between the servant and Israel posited above. The servant is the representative of and model for his people. They share a common calling to be the servant of Yahweh, a light to the nations, etc. Third, two appellations in the servant songs besides the term servant are at least consistent with, if they do not support, the proposed second Moses identification. The first is the term my chosen in 42:1. Moses is called his chosen in Psalm 106:23. The second is the term Israel found in 49:3. He said to me, you are my servant Israel, in whom I will display my splendor. While Moses is never called Israel, on three occasions he would have been so called had Yahweh prevailed in his expressed wish. The first of these was immediately after the golden calf incident in Exodus 32:9 and following. Yahweh said to Moses, I have seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and of you I will make a great nation. Employing the vocabulary of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12:2, which was reapplied to Jacob and Israel in Genesis 46:3, Yahweh promised Moses that he would now become the sole heir of that covenant. He would be the new Israel. Fifth, the endowment with God's Spirit mentioned in 42:1 may find its source in the emphasis on Moses' possession of the Spirit in Numbers 11:17 following. Sixth, the servant's calling to establish justice, which is repeated in 42:1-3-4, and which is paralleled with the promise that the coastlands wait for his law in 42:4, suitably escalates in its universal application the work of the original Moses who established justice and law for Israel. Like Isaiah's servant, Moses was more than a prophet, he was a lawgiver. Seventh, although the call narrative in 49:1 and following offers significant parallels to Jeremiah 1:4-10. It is widely recognized that the narrative in Jeremiah is itself based on the call of Moses. More particularly, the servant's objection to his call and sense of futility in 49:4, as well as his unpromising origin in 53:1 and following, find a plausible antecedent in the complaint of the self-doubting Moses in Exodus 3:11. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Likewise, the theme of meekness in the servant's demeanor and proclamation in 42:2-3 may echo Moses' unimpressive, at least by his own estimate, locution. 8. Although the expression to give, present as a covenant is nowhere used of the original Moses, it seems entirely apt to describe one whose role is modeled on Moses as the mediator of the covenant at Sinai. To obey Moses was to obey the covenant. 9. The recurrent themes of the servant's rejection by the people, his suffering, and his submissive response to opposition have obvious relevance for a second Moses figure if his experience is to parallel that of the original Moses. The mention, "grave with the wicked," in Isaiah 53:9 may continue the themes of rejection and the apparent miscarriage of justice that was the immediate cause of the servant's sufferings and death. They made his grave with the wicked, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Alternatively, it may recall Moses' burial site in the wilderness, the place in which an entire generation of disobedient Israelites was condemned to die. 10. Isaiah 53:12 concludes the fourth servant song. Yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Consistent with the view that Isaiah's servant refers to the expected second Moses, Psalm 99:6, quoted above, highlights Moses' ministry of intercession as a prominent aspect of his priestly calling. 11. In 53:5, the healing that comes through the servant, by his bruises we are healed, may also support a second Moses theme. The Pentateuch offers several examples of Moses' healing ministry, which may also have contributed to the emphasis on healing in the ministry of Elijah, who is widely recognized as a second Moses figure. 12. In terms of the fourth servant song, perhaps the most significant aspect of Moses' intercessory work was the fact that in his attempt to make atonement for Israel's idolatry with the golden calf, he invoked upon himself the well-justified wrath of Yahweh. Given the many examples in the second Exodus of escalation over the original event, a similar escalation in the experience and calling of the prophet like Moses should not be unexpected. Although the original Moses was not permitted to endure the wrath of Yahweh on behalf of his guilty people, this second Moses would be. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. And then his last one, it is possible that the promise, he shall see his offspring and shall prolong his days, implies an additional escalation of the experience of the original Moses. If, as observed by R.J. Clifford, the expression prolonged days has the meaning that it does in Deuteronomy. Let the mother bird go, taking only the young for yourself, in order that it may go well with you and you may live long. Then the second Moses will be allowed to enjoy life in the promised land. Moreover, given the ample evidence in the immediate context for the metaphorical use of the term seed as a reference to Israel, it appears that the second Moses may experience the realization of Yahweh's canceled promise slash threat to Moses in Exodus 32:10 to raise up from him a new Israel. So those are the reasons that he gives as to why he thinks that the servant in the servant songs is the promised, the one promised to Moses when God said, I will send a prophet like you in the future. And so those are the reasons that he gives. I won't have time to go into the other stuff that I was going to talk about, so I will save that till next week. But this, whether Hugenberger is right or not in associating the servant with the second Moses, I am convinced that Isaiah is drawing fairly heavily on this theme of the Exodus at the time of Moses, to talk about the events that he is prophesying, in particular the return of the Jews from Babylon. And I will build on that in my comments when I continue this next week. But any questions on Hugenberger?
Couldn't a second Moses even refer to the Messiah? Wasn't Jesus in many ways filling that role?
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. But what Hugenberger is trying to figure out is, what could the readers of Isaiah, when he wrote it, how could they have identified the servant? And they're saying there is something in their cultural milieu that they could point to and say, that's what he's talking about, and it's the second Moses.
Would they ever have thought of the Messiah role being a second Moses?
I don't know whether they would have been able to make that connection or not. Any other questions or comments? Okay, so we'll just quit there, and then I'll pick up next week where he left off.